It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Santa Talos is back to spread holiday cheer, to crush you in the warm hearth of his fiery embrace.
Please do not go.
Chestnuts roasting on his open fire.
Incense is cold outside of my body.
Hephaestus bless us, everyone.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we are back to discuss some more invented toys.
That's right. We're opening Santa Talos's bag once more, pulling out some classic toys to discuss where they came from. Like, how do these various gadgets and novelties factor into human techno history?
Now, last time we talked about the discus or the frisbee. We talked about the hula hoop. Mm-hmm. What else? The jack in the box.
Yes.
And with at least two of those things, I feel like there were times, like, there's an ebb and flow for demand. Mm-hmm. There are, like, moments when suddenly a toy, even a classic toy that's been around for a long time, suddenly gets very popular again, and then demand goes away. And I wonder what creates those cycles. Like, I remember when I was in elementary school, there was suddenly a yo-yo craze. And I don't know if this was, like, worldwide, nationwide, or just my school. I don't know exactly why it was or exactly which year it was, but there was, like, a year or two when everybody went yo-yo crazy, and then it just disappeared.
Huh. Well, I wonder if it's kind of an age thing, too. I mean, just like how there's a certain age at which, as a child, you discover the magic of the yo-yo, and it is incredibly magical. But then it goes away, or at least very few individuals stick with it long term. But I know even at my son's school, they had a professional yo-yo performer come in and do some sort of demonstration about the yo-yo.
Oh, I wonder if we had something like that. Maybe that caused it. But I do remember there was, like, I remember the brand names. Like, everybody wanted a butterfly or something like that.
Well, also, I think an important thing perhaps is that certainly you have this, like, 20-year cycle roughly for toys. Whatever was popular 20 years ago when you were a kid, then statistically when you're having children, you then return to the same toys and inflict them on the next generation. But during that time, material sciences tend to evolve, right? Uh-huh. And if not only material sciences, but also, electronic gadgetry. So suddenly it's possible to have a butterfly yo-yo that is not only just a yo-yo, but also has has, you know, this, say, really gleaming plastic form, or perhaps it has lights in it now, that sort of thing.
What were those automatic retraction yo-yos? Do you remember those?
No, isn't that just a yo-yo?
No. The yo-yo, in order to get it to climb back up the string, you've got to get the momentum just right. You've got to kind of tug it, you know, at the right
moment. This is like an electric yo-yo? It's like the electric bicycle of yo-yos?
I don't know if it was electric. It might have been spring-powered, but basically it was automatically retracting. So you would throw it down the thread, and then when it hit the end, it would just get sucked back in.
I don't know if I approve of that.
It didn't seem like a lot of fun. It seems more like a weapon than a yo-yo.
It's interesting you should mention that. So the first toy we're going to mention here is the yo-yo. And the yo-yo, it is a magical implement. Like anytime, I don't use one daily or anything now, but every now and then I'll happen upon a yo-yo and I'll have to do the one trick I know how to do with it. The sort of, not the standard, but the one where you kind of roll your hand. I have no idea what the name of the trick is.
The roll your hand? I don't know that.
You know, where instead of going, nobody can see this. Instead of going like this, you go like this.
I see. Yeah. Like underhand instead of overhand.
Yeah. There's more of a flourish to it.
I remember the tricks everybody was trying to do when I was a kid were walk the dog, where I guess roll ahead of you or something. Then they would do like they'd like make a cat's cradle with the string while it's still spinning.
Yeah. And the thing is, nowadays on YouTube, you can go and look up yo-yo tricks, and yo-yo tricks are amazing. Like, there are people doing incredible things with yo-yos and yo-yo-related toys.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic, though, is pretty standard. The toy consists of two discs that are connected by an axle with a string looped around the axle. You unwind it, the yo-yo spins down, and then it spins back up. That is the basic yo-yo trick.
Yeah, and I would say that's good enough. If you never learn any tricks, the yo-yo is still pretty fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So where does this come from? Well, let's start with the American history of the yo-yo, because a lot of these toys, as in the last episode, there's kind of the American history and then there's kind of the global history of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the American history of these toys tends to sort of dominate our current understanding of them, generally because they ended up being revamped by various American toy companies.
Yeah.
So
made a lot of money.
Yeah, and made a lot of money in doing so. And then generally got to rename them. And this is another case where something like that comes into place. So the American history of the yo-yo is often tied back to the 1920s. And one of the key names here is Donald F. Duncan, the founder of Duncan Toys Company. And I'll refer back to Charles Panati's Extraordinary Origins of Everyday Things. And he points out that Duncan took inspiration, supposedly, for his yo-yo from observations of the Philippine hunting weapon known as a yo-yo, as it was known in the Tagalog language. And this would have been, I read, a larger wooden take on the basic concept with the twine intended to wrap around a prey animal's legs. So it's more like a bolus, basically.
Right, like the weapon that is sort of two balls on a string and you throw it and it's, I guess, can get tangled up in an animal's legs and trip them.
Yes. So sometimes you'll find accounts that point to Donald F. Duncan as an inventor of the yo-yo or like the key modern innovator of the yo-yo. But this appears to not be truly the case. It appears that a Filipino immigrant by the name of Pedro Flores actually brought the invention to the toy market in Santa Barbara and ran the yo-yo manufacturing company.
Huh.
But then he sold his interest in the company and the trademark to Duncan, who then marketed it heavily. But even Flores hadn't been the first person to patent some form of yo-yo technology in the United States. A form of bandolier had been patented already, which is a very similar gadget. But more to the point, the basic yo-yo toy predates all of this, even seemingly the Filipino weapon, because there are Greek vase paintings from around 440 BCE that depict the use of a yo-yo.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Chinese had an ivory and silk cord version of basically the same device as early as 1000 BCE. And earlier versions date back to the Neolithic Himudu civilization, potentially from 5500 BCE to 3300 BCE, where it may have spun off from spinning top technology, which I think is interesting to note because the yo-yo, you can watch a yo-yo in action and then you can watch a spin top in action.
Mm-hmm.
And you can realize that they're both basically revolving around the same principle, mm-hmm. the idea of using a length of string or twine to spin another physical object.
Uh-huh.
In the top, you're spinning it on the ground, but then the yo-yo is taking basically the same concept and applying it above the ground.
Uh-huh. And they're both benefiting from the kind of magic that appears to happen when you preserve angular momentum. In a way, I don't know if they technically count, but they're sort of analogous to the mechanical object, a flywheel, which, you mm-hmm. know, it preserves the ability to do work in angular momentum stored in a rotating object.
Yeah, to sort of abuse the pun a little more. Basically, the toy is a spinoff of emerging technology of the time.
Uh-huh.
And it also, I think, gets to the point that, you know, toys are not merely toys. You know, they don't exist in isolation. They're directly connected to advances in technology, material sciences, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking a little bit more about the Chinese top. I was looking at a paper titled The Chinese Top, published in 2008 in the Chinese Journal for the History of Science and Technology by Yanping et al. And they point that, yes, the likely origin is roughly 5,000 BCE or thereabouts during the Himudu civilization. But actual writings on tops and diabolos don't emerge until the Song in Ming Dynasty. So that would have been – the Song would have been 960 through 1279 and the Ming Dynasty 1368 to 1644.
Now, what's the deal with this diabolo or diablo?
So it is if you look up diabolo on YouTube, for instance, you'll see plenty of videos of people using the toy, the technology. And it is a standard – essentially, you can think of it as like a Chinese yo-yo. You may have even seen one before at, say, you know, an Asian cultural event like a street festival,
mm-hmm.
and you might have thought to yourself, oh, it's like a Chinese yo-yo or something. But they're often the person using the yo-yo often uses sticks as well. And it's widely used often as a kind of a circus prop for really elaborate tricks. The main difference is that it's – instead of it being two discs joined by an axis, it's two hourglass shapes bridged by an axle and then manipulated with, you know, with the string and with sticks to perform a variety of tricks. Today you'll find plenty of diabolo models wherever you might order a Western yo-yo, like it's typical. If you're a yo-yo manufacturer of note, you probably offer this
model
as well.
Here.
Yeah. You want to be the master of all, like, above ground spinning top like toys.
Uh-huh. We've cornered the angular momentum market.
But, you know, it's I think one of the reasons the yo-yo is such a successful toy and has been for so long is because it fits that classic trope of being something that is very easy to use but then difficult to master. Like there's a lot of depth that can be added. You can get off at the first stop on the yo-yo train, or you can ride the yo-yo train all the way to the end and become one of these masters of string and spin.
I wonder if there's a way of studying exactly what it is about the mechanical action of certain toys bringing such pleasure. Like why is it in particular that, say, two spinning discs on a string or a paddleboard ball or something like that, just normal physical interactions bring such visceral pleasure, whereas other random combinations of objects don't necessarily? Like, say, a stick with the string on the end with a rock on it. you don't think that would be very fun. But why would a paddleboard with a bouncy rubber ball is fun, and there's some difference there in like how it feels in your hand and how it bounces. But like, what makes one thing fun and another thing not fun?
I think one possibility is first of all, is the toy doing something or achieving something that feels slightly unnatural,
mm-hmm.
Because with the yo-yo, as opposed to just a string on the end of a stick, the yo-yo returns to you. And certainly we know the physics of how this works, but you can imagine like the seeming miracle of the thing, you know? So the boomerang effect of the object that you created returning to its master. And then I think it might be a situation too, and certainly the more clockwork our toys become, the idea that the toy is doing something on its own,
mm-hmm.
That we've created something that has, if not, you know, actual mind and intent, it at least has it seems to have a certain amount of life unto itself.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could even look at something as simple as a discus or a frisbee in this way because it is, in effect, a wing. And so, like, it sails farther than it seems like it should maybe. Yeah, I like this idea, having some kind of hidden mechanism, even if that mechanism is not clockwork on the inside or something, but is just some counterintuitive effect of basic physics. And actually, the next toy I want to talk about I think fits into this category of doing something that's just slightly mechanically counterintuitive, and that's where the fun seems to come in. But before we go there, I think we need to take a break. Okay, so we all know how a VPN protects your privacy and security online. But one cool thing we found out recently is that you can use a VPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries.
That's right. For instance, you could use ExpressVPN to binge watch Doctor Who on UK Netflix or Rick and Morty on French Netflix. You know, that's all you have to do is you just fire up the ExpressVPN app, change your location, and refresh Netflix, and you're good to go.
ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. So you can choose from almost 100 different countries. Just think about all the Netflix libraries you can get to.
Yeah, I mean, are you a fan of anime? Well, you can use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. but it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. So Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, you name it.
There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason we recommend ExpressVPN to watch shows is it's ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD with no problem.
ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more, so you can watch what you want on the go or on the big screen wherever you are.
If you visit our special link right now, expressvpn.com/invention, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/invention.
All right, we're back. Let's move on to our next toy.
All right, so this next story starts with an American man named Richard Thompson James, who was born in Delaware in 1914. And it wasn't until reading up on this guy that I realized how many mildly famous people there were named Richard James. This is not Richard D. James, the British electronic musician, also known as Aphex Twin.
Oh, yeah.
This is not Rick James, the super freaky musician. It is not many of the other Richard Jameses who are various kinds of politicians and scientists and other stuff. This Richard James grew up in Delaware, went to Penn State, got a degree in mechanical engineering there. And in 1943, Richard James was working as a mechanical engineer for a shipbuilding company at Cramp's Shipyard in Philadelphia. So this was in the middle of World War II, and naval technology, of course, was not just big business. It was an essential part of the Allied war effort. According to one story I read in The Atlantic by Emma Jacobs, Cramp's Shipyard at this time alone employed up to 18,000 workers at once during the height of the war. And many of these employees, of course, were engineers working on design improvements for ships that would fight in fronts like the long-running Battle of the Atlantic, you know, that was going on for many years at the time. Personally, Richard James was trying to design mechanisms to, quote, support and stabilize sensitive instruments aboard ships in rough seas. So you can kind of think about the challenges to fragile navigation instruments and scientific detectors that might be present aboard a battleship that's pitching around in the waves or a submarine that's climbing up and down through the water column. And so he's working on this, and his workspace is covered in steel parts, including tension and torsion springs. And apparently one day in 1943 – Richard James accidentally knocked over a container of metal parts that he was storing on a shelf above his desk. One of these parts was a spring, and instead of just falling with a splat, the spring kind of walked downhill in arcing steps down onto a stack of books and then onto the floor where it came to rest. And according to James, he immediately saw the potential of a spring like this as a toy, primarily for the reason that if he were to make the spring of just the right tension and mass, it would walk around gracefully and surely bring delight to children everywhere with a simple demonstration of everyday physics.
Now, obviously, I cannot help but picture Richard James here as looking exactly like the man in the old MST3K Rift short, A Case of Spring Fever.
No springs!
Yes, a man who, in a moment of weakness, wishes that there were no springs upon the earth. And then coyly, the spring gremlin, spirit, god, answers this wish, grants this wish, and shows him just how broken the world would be without springs. He takes it back, says, please, bring all the springs back. Coyly just immediately brings springs back into the world. And then he becomes an ambassador of springs to all his friends. He becomes a prophet of springs.
It's a complete ripoff of It's a Wonderful Life, but replacing George Bailey with springs. that is a great short. If you've never seen it, you should look it up. But anyway, Richard's wife, Betty James, came up with the name for this toy by picking a word out of the dictionary, and that name was, of course, you all know it, the Slinky. Now, I think we associate that word more with the toy than we actually do with the original meaning of the word. It was a word in the English language. Merriam-Webster now defines it as stealthily quiet or sleek and sinuous in movement or outline. And I think it's more that like second definition that Betty James had in mind. But also I believe she said something about it making a sound as it moved that kind of sounded like slink.
Okay, that would make sense because the original word is more like it's like it's describing a serpent or the tiger burning bright in the darkness of the night, you know, as opposed to a coil of metal that makes a weird noise as it goes down the stairs.
But it is a kind of graceful, almost kind of stealthy little noise. When you think about what a slinky sounds like, it's you hear the mass transfer, and you hear the tone of it rapidly moving as the mass transfers.
Yeah, there is something about the sound of the slinky alone that is intoxicating, especially to a young child, but I think to adults too. But a child especially will get the slinky and begin to do the back and forth with it, creating that sound effect until adults tell them to please be quiet with that slinky. Just that sound of the shush, shush, shush,
right,
going from hand to hand. And then, of course, the feel of that as well.
Totally. It's orally and tactily intoxicating. It's just one of those things. I mean, kind of like a yo-yo. There's just some kind of basic mechanical action that we find very appealing and want to keep paying attention to.
The slinky especially feels very organic. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it does. Its movements do have at least slight parallels in, say, the world of worms and even human digestion.
Oh, yeah. So it's kind of peristalsis, yeah.
Yeah.
But the versions we're familiar with are like the later versions that were perfectly calibrated to work like a worm or an esophagus or however, you know. So in the years following the discovery, the design actually had to get there. So Richard James tinkered with it, trying to find the perfect material and design for the spring. I read that he ended up using a high carbon steel wire about like 1.46 millimeters wide. And when he demonstrated the slinky for kids who lived in the neighborhood, they were enchanted. They really liked it. So Richard and Betty James, they thought, hey, you know, I think we've got a business on our hands. We could manufacture this toy and make some money. So to start a business, they secured a $500 loan from a friend. And Richard contracted a machinist to build 400 slinkies to his specifications. Apparently, initial marketing wasn't easy. I was reading about this in an article on the history of the slinky written by a writer named Zachary Crockett. And this makes it clear that the toy was not an instant hit in the commercial sense. Like apparently some toy sellers believed the original Slinky to be kind of plain, dull, or boring and couldn't be convinced that there would be any demand. Now, remember, at this point, even though it was basically the same toy we have today, it was just dull carbon steel wire. There were no tie-dye colors or anything like that, which you might find on some plastic slinkies of the present.
Right. But still the classic slinky, the classic just gray, dull slinky, like that's – I feel like that's the one that's ultimately the most intoxicating because it has that metallic sound and it has that – it has a smell. The Slinky has a distinctive smell that is weirdly pleasing.
Slinky by Calvin Klein.
Yeah, it's
Ode to Slink.
Like it's – you know, it has kind of like that – it's the metallic taste of of, you know, having bit the inside of your lip, except without the pain. You know, there's something, you know, there's a taste of blood in the smell of the Slinky. And I feel like that's part of its weird appeal.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, I also think that the original, like the regular dull metal Slinky without all the plastic and colors and all that stuff, it is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I don't think of it as dull, but I think maybe it had something just to do with the packaging at the time. I think they were selling it just wrapped in sort of unadorned paper, you know, like they didn't have a colorful box or anything like that.
All right. And also when the Slinky is not in motion, if it's just presented to you as this weird
just a
cylinder
metal tube,
yeah, it's like what you need is at least an image of it opening, right, of it assuming its bipedal form.
Mm-hmm. But after a lot of early disappointment, Richard and Betty James did have a major success in 1945 when Richard decided to give a live demonstration of the Slinky in Gimbel's department store in Philadelphia during the Christmas shopping season. And this demonstration included James showing how the Slinky would walk down a ramp from top to bottom. So, you know, they'd set up a plank and set it at the top and let it arc and walk all the way down. And, of course, the people there who were presumably out doing their Christmas shopping were so into it. James ended up selling his entire stock of 400 Slinkies in about 90 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And then there was a whole crowd of shoppers who wanted more Slinkies. So by Christmas, they'd had more manufactured by the machinist. They sold thousands of them. And then all sorts of opportunities opened up. There was interest in Richard and Betty James' pitch at major toy makers conventions. I think there was one in 1946. And Richard James filed for a patent on his invention in August 1946 and was granted it in January 1947. Robert, I've got an illustration of the patent for you here. I think it looks essentially identical to the Slinky you would buy in a toy store today.
Yeah, it's undeniably a Slinky.
Yeah, there's no major design difference I can tell. The thing, you know, might have changed very slightly in the gauge of the wire or something, but it's a Slinky. It's the Slinky you know. And after this, it kind of was an instant hit. So like by 1947, the Slinky was known all over the United States. It was clearly a huge success as a toy. The company owned by Richard and Betty James began to manufacture the Slinkies themselves instead of contracting with this outside machinist. They massively scaled up production. And in the first couple of years, they sold more than 100 million Slinkies at $1 a piece.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, there were tons of derivative toys, right? Like you've seen them, the Slinky Caterpillar, the Slinky Dog.
Oh, Slinky Dog, like in Toy Story.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there were all kinds of things like that. It wasn't just the regular old Slinky, but I think the regular old Slinky always remained sort of a centerpiece of the business, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking back now on all the uses I put a Slinky to. So obviously you can do the back and forth in your hand. You can have it walk down some stairs because, of course, parents and grandparents love it if you find new ways to play on a long flight of wooden stairs in a house.
Right.
but then there are other things too, like the like sticking your arm through the Slinky and making like a robot arm, pretending the Slinky is some sort of a communications tube, putting it around figurines and stuff. I wonder if part of the appeal of the Slinky is that it is undeniably like a piece of industry, a piece of industrial technology that then you are free to play with your imagination.
Even though it's sold as a toy, it almost feels like a found toy. And isn't a found toy so much more magical, the way that a cat will love a crumpled up ball of aluminum foil in a way that it will never love a toy manufactured to be enjoyed by cats?
Right. Yeah, I mean, in a way, really, what James did was he figured out how to sell springs to children. But not quite that. Like, if we were just to say that, we wouldn't be giving him enough credit because obviously he took the basic concept of the spring, worked on it, refined it to create not a true spring but like a spring-based toy.
I mean, it is still a spring. It's probably not a spring that would be I don't know, especially useful in all that many right. mechanical contexts, but I think is, you know, something that is much like a slinky in about the same tension and mass and all that is used in a few ways.
Right. I mean, it's still in its own way, it is sort of storing energy, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's just maybe not as, it's not as pronounced as the spring that, say, shoots a toy across the room or, you know, factors into the suspension of some sort of a vehicle.
Yeah. Well I think we... it is working as a spring. You know, mm-hmm. it's storing potential energy in the tension or the torsion on the wire.
Mm-hmm.
I think it absolutely is a spring. Like the enjoyment we get out of it is the enjoyment of the action of a spring.
But it is at least the spring made into novelty.
Yes, and a lot of the subsequent novelty came from like outside the original family. Like, I don't think it was Richard James who came up with like the slinky dog. I've seen that attributed. The slinky dog design was attributed to a woman named Helen Malsed, mm-hmm. Who I guess came up with this idea. But so you might think the story ends there, right? Fame, wealth, slinky's a big hit. But there is actually a bizarre twist to the story of the success of the Slinky and the company that Richard and Betty James founded. Once they became very successful, I've read about – I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but there was apparently a lot of trouble in the family. Like Richard James apparently showed off some bizarre and not very admirable behavior. One strange quote I found is Richard and Betty's son Tom – at some point said, quote, "Pop used to say money means nothing to me and he would tear it up. I'd find it and tape it back together." Now, in a way, I have a lot of admiration for the anti-materialist point of view, but not so much if that just means you end up tearing up money, which, you know, you could donate that.
Yeah, there are other things you could do with the money that is not destroying it.
Yeah, but then he did end up donating a lot of money. In fact, the family's entire fortune. But what he donated it to was various extreme religious organizations. Uh-huh. And in 1960, Richard James abruptly left his family behind and moved to a rural area of Bolivia to join what his wife Betty referred to as an evangelical Christian cult. And he stayed there until he died in the 1970s. But after Richard left, Betty assumed control of the company that they'd founded together, and things were really rough here. Slinky sales were down by 1960. The company was deeply in debt, and Richard James had spent all the previous years funneling away all the profits made by the Slinky into various evangelical religious sects. And Betty James was faced with these problems, but she actually did manage to turn the company's fortunes around. Among other moves, I know she arranged some kind of payment schedule with the company's creditors that would help them get out of debt. She increased sales by introducing new products and by commissioning a new advertising campaign, which is where we get those classic Slinky TV commercials with the song everybody knows, "Everyone Loves a Slinky."
I don't know if I know that song.
Who walks the stair without a care and makes the happiest sound? Bounce up and down just like a clown. Everyone knows it's Slinky. The best present yet to give or get. The favorite all over town. The hit of the day when you're ready to play. Everyone knows it's Slinky. It's Slinky. It's Slinky. For fun it's a
better time. Oh, okay. I have heard this. Yes, that jingle is undeniable.
You know, I just realized when I was preparing for this that the It's Log commercial from Ren and Stimpy is supposed to be the Slinky commercial.
Oh, it's Log.
It's almost
log.
Exactly the
it's
same
big, it's
song.
It's big, it's heavy, it's wood.
Yes, it's better than bad, it's good. I love the It's Log commercial, especially the way that it says things that are just obviously untrue, like it fits on your back, it's great for a snack, it's log, log, log. But there actually is a way in which the parody runs deeper. The joke being beyond just absurd is actually kind of insightful. Like the steel spring, like the log, is something that isn't obviously a toy at first glance. It's all about how you frame it to people.
Yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily look at a steel spring and say that's a toy the same way you wouldn't assume a log is a toy. But the joke is that once you assert that it's a toy, the steel spring kind of works and the log just doesn't. I don't know, unless maybe I'm not looking at logs the right way.
No, I mean, the thing is, the log is just a log,
uh-huh.
Whereas the Slinky, again, it feels kind of alive. It can be manipulated in basic ways that a log cannot, and therefore the Slinky lends itself to imagination play.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. So anyway, Betty James ran the company from when she took over in 1960 until 1998 when she retired, and she passed away in 2008. And one interesting fact that I don't know, it was interesting to me, is that Slinkies always remained relatively cheap. The original toys in 1945 sold at Gimbel's for a dollar a piece, but even as of 1996, prices for Slinkies were between like $1.89, $2.69. And Betty James once told the New York Times, quote, "So many children can't have expensive toys, and I feel a real obligation to them. I'm appalled when I go Christmas shopping and $60 to $80 for a toy is nothing. With 16 grandchildren, you can go into the national debt." I wonder if that's a thing a lot of parents would appreciate, that like you can actually have a toy that people get a lot of enjoyment out of and it's not like a $60 toy. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, that's the best. It costs next to nothing and you got so much play out of it. Whereas the worst examples are, of course, the expensive toys that don't get played with and just set there.
I remember, though, wanting those really expensive toys when I was a kid, like wanting the G.I. Joe Fortress kind of thing,
they had some like big G.I. Joe, like Cobra Coliseum type structure.
Uh-huh.
And I had a friend who had one. It was enormous. Like, I wonder how many of those they made and where they ended up.
Yeah. But do you actually end up playing with that thing as much as you would play with a yo-yo or a Slinky? I don't know.
Yeah. Like, take, for instance, Castle Grayskull, the classic, the big item originally for the Masters of the Universe He-Man action figures.
Uh-huh.
I wonder how much my main memories are not of really playing with it per se, but of staring at an illustration of it on a box or something. Like, it was something about the advertising for it, the idea of it, and ultimately the pining for the thing is more powerful than the product.
Yeah.
Whereas the Slinky more than delivers on the promise on the package.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you will keep playing with the Slinky until it gets tangled up and ruined.
Right.
But even when that happens, you can get another one for like $1.50.
Yeah. Some people swear by the use of a Slinky as a squirrel prevention device for a bird feeder.
Really?
Instead of of course, you can get custom-made devices that prevent a squirrel from climbing up the pole of a bird feeder.
Mm-hmm.
But some say you can just take a Slinky and put it around the pole and have it hanging there, and then squirrels won't be able to climb it.
Huh.
I tried it. I found that it did not work for me, but maybe
squirrels
I was doing
too crafty.
Wrong. Yeah, squirrels are crafty, and they eventually, and at least in my case, they figured out what we were trying to do.
All right, let's take one more break, and then when we come back, we will discuss another invented toy.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So I have to admit that I both love and hate a good jigsaw puzzle.
Jigsaw puzzle. Yeah. You know what my association with jigsaw puzzles is? For some reason, we didn't really do them at home, but I remember the family would always do one on a vacation.
Yes, yeah, like at a beach house kind of environment.
Oh, you did that too?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my uncle and stuff, I think, would like get a jigsaw puzzle and do it on the table in like a beach condo or something.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of jigsaw puzzles out there now, obviously. For my money, I think a good jigsaw puzzle has to be created in line with a piece of art that I care about, you know? Mm-hmm. Like it's a puzzle to be solved, even though you know what the solution is going to be because it's on the front of the box. But you're building this piece of art, so I have to care about the finished piece. And I think it also helps that the art needs to be detailed and varied. For instance, I finally look back on a jigsaw puzzle that I helped assemble on a beach trip one depiction of the Tibetan Wheel of Samsara, which is great because it's perfect. It has all these little details, these different scenes, all sorts of intricate little beings. And recently, my family assembled a big Ravensburger jigsaw puzzle featuring an original work of surreal art. Ravensburger, by the way, a major German jigsaw puzzle maker, and they also make a 1,000-piece puzzle utilizing the Tower of Babel by Bruegel the Elder that I'd love to take a crack at because, you know, again, an intricate piece of art with a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
But still, when I work on a jigsaw puzzle like that, I feel this weird mixture of pleasure and frustration, you know, tinged with addiction as I just have to keep going. Like each time I actually find a piece and get it in its spot, like I get this, you know, release of, I don't know, dopamine, I guess, and I have to keep going. And then I'll say, just one more piece, and then I'll go back to whatever I was working on. But then I keep going until I just run out of mental energy for the jigsaw puzzle.
We need to talk about your jigsaw puzzle, Robert.
And then one more thing about just my experience of them is, of course, the ideal strategy is to assemble the edges first.
Yeah.
And then you work on the more notable things you can put together. Like, okay, clearly we've got a bright color here, or these are clearly pieces of the same structure or creature. Mm-hmm. But then eventually you get to the point where it's just the most boring pieces left that you have to fit into the puzzle.
Well, that's why I think if you're going to have an image for a jigsaw puzzle, it's really good if the image is busy, if there's a lot of stuff going on everywhere and there's not like a lot of blank space in it.
Right.
That makes for less fun jigsaw puzzle.
For instance, I wouldn't want to do a Jackson Pollock jigsaw puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
I love the work of Jackson Pollock. I'm not going to be one of those people who, you know, scoffs at it. But it's one of the last things I would want to put together on a jigsaw puzzle. I want little fairies and demons and figures and medieval peasantry.
Representative art, yeah.
Yeah. So this begs the question. Where do jigsaw puzzles come from? Well, they actually have their origins in the 18th century creation of dissected maps. This was a novelty born out of the world of cartography and also with strong connections to a European imperial zeal for national borders.
Mm.
As described in Cutting Borders, Dissected Maps and the Origins of the Jigsaw Puzzle by Martin Norgay, published in a 2007 edition of the Cartographic Journal, these dissected maps were maps that were mounted on wood and then cut out along national borders, which feels fittingly imperial, right? To first map the world as it is, then to divide it artificially with these different human division lines, and then to physically cut up the map, slice the regions apart, and then put them back together again for amusement.
It seems like an absolutely perfect outgrowth of like 18th century European culture.
Right.
Like suddenly jazzed up on the idea of nations with fixed borders and boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is something that a lot of people don't realize because we live in a world with well-defined borders today. That is historically not the norm. Mm-hmm. You know, in the past, you just had people living in places, and then there might be various imperial powers exerting some kind of pressure on them, and whichever one was exerting more pressure, you might consider your ruler. But like, you know, people were just living in places. There often wasn't a clearly defined border or boundary.
Yeah. Like some of the early examples here I'm going to discuss are specifically English, but also French as well. Mm-hmm. And so like, this is a time where to be, you know, truly English was to be able to point to the map and say, behold, there is the British Empire.
Right.
And these are, areas of particular interest to the British Empire. These are the enemies of the British Empire. And to make a huge emphasis on these division lines, and then to even teach younger people, the importance of all of these abstract divisions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that goes way back in the British tradition. Even Roman Britain, the idea of why was Hadrian's Wall put up? There are all kinds of things, ideas about defending the areas of northern England from the Scots of the time or whatever, the tribes that were occupying what is now Scotland. But there's also just an idea that it was somewhat symbolic. It's symbolizing like, okay, here is where the conquered, the Roman part of Britain begins. Mm. And we're establishing a border by the erection of this wall.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in a way, Hadrian's Wall is the predecessor to the proper jigsaw puzzle. So this article by Norgate is a wonderful overview, and he discusses first of all the process for making them. And this would have been rather simple if you had the right tools, and certainly if you were around in the right time during cartographical history. The basic version is simply a paper map pasted onto wood, and then the wood is cut along the boundaries. These pieces, however, could easily warp, so additional layers tended to be added, such as paper backing. With the right tools, you could do this as a craft or even as kind of like a cottage trade. But then ultimately, industrial innovations come along that make stack cutting possible. So you can cut multiple puzzles, multiple dissected maps at once. And then, of course, today, when we get to actual jigsaw puzzles, they're typically rolled out via industrial presses and assembly lines. Lasers are even used.
Does anybody still use wooden, like actually straight up wooden jigsaw puzzles, or is it pretty much all cardboard these days?
You'll certainly find wooden, very simple wooden puzzles at times for young children.
Uh-huh.
But the ones that I tend to see are not like they're a shape in a wooden hole for that shape.
Yeah,
I'm sure somebody is making authentic pieces though. But originally, this was more of a fancy thing that was created by cartographers.
Mm.
And we have some examples that survive to this day. In terms of where it comes from, historians often point to a British cartographer by the name of John Spilsbury, who lived 1739 through 1769. And he's sometimes credited as the inventor of the dissected map and ultimately the inventor of the jigsaw puzzle. He was an apprentice to Thomas Jeffreys, royal geographer to King George III. And surviving Spilsbury puzzles are quite rare, and they were not cheap even at the time. They were not intended for a mass general audience. But still, he does seem to be the first person to create them and sell them. And he was certainly doing so by 1763. And then after him, others follow in his footsteps, and they advance the art and the craft of this new sort of puzzle. However, as Norgate points out, he was not seemingly the first person to create a dissected map. This honor, he argues, might go to Madame de Beaumont, who lived 1711 through 1780, a French author and educator who lived in England from 1748 to 1762. We can't be 100% certain, but she's the earliest figure that we can really point to on this, apparently. And she was certainly in the right place to fit into the history. She was governess to the niece of Lady Charlotte Finch, and Finch was in turn governess to the children of George III. And the Beaumont wooden maps, as they were referred to in some writings at the time, were used as educational aids because at the time it was, of course, considered important to educate English children about the pride of their nation, its colonial ventures, and its place in the world. And at the time, educational theory had come to accept that educational instruction, such as in geography, could actually be enjoyable to a child. You could do something that is fun or fun-ish, and they could actually learn from it.
Well, I think there are still puzzles like this today. Like, I don't know if we call them jigsaw puzzles, but they are essentially jigsaw puzzles that are just maps. Like, you fill in the 50 states of the United States with the cutout puzzle pieces.
Yeah, you will find dissected maps. You can still certainly obtain them. Of course, you can also find maps as a popular subject for jigsaw puzzles, which we'll get to the, you know, the distinction here in a minute. But here's an interesting fact about Madame de Beaumont. She's actually best known for writing the most popular version of Beauty and the Beast in 1756.
Why did I think Beauty and the Beast was what's that that French folklorist guy?
Well, there was an older version of it for sure, but but she abridged it and rewrote it, and her version apparently was very well read at the time.
Interesting.
Interesting fact. Also, while in London, she was also romantically involved with French spy Thomas Pichon. I've seen her credited as his wife in some sources, but it seems that they lived together but never married, and he continued residing in that home after she returned to France. Now, how do we get from dissected maps to what we now think of as jigsaw puzzles? Well, I want to read a quote from Norgate's article because I think he sums it up very nicely. Quote, "The idea of interlocking jigsaw pieces was introduced in the early 19th century and was probably inspired by the shape of dovetail joints in everyday cabinet making. It was first applied to the surrounding border of the jigsaw so that the picture would not slip apart as it was being put together. The distinctive, quote, barfoot interlocking of the period resembles dovetail joints with rounded corners. Later still, whole puzzles were made of fully interlocking pieces." So I think that's interesting. We see other innovations emerging for the jigsaw puzzle out of the carpentry world. And then at the same time, these new approaches ultimately destroy the geographical educational aspect of the thing, you know, charting a new course into pure novel puzzle solving. And yet at the same time, like we pointed out, you still can find essentially dissected maps. You can maps are still a popular jigsaw puzzle subject, but existing and custom artwork have also become a huge part of the tradition.
Yeah.
In a way, it reminds me of the journey from Spring to Slinky. You know, from dissected map to jigsaw puzzle, taking something that an invention that has more of a purpose and then finding like the thing that is intoxicating about it and refining it towards that.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, it's exactly that kind of thing that makes it – I mean, I can't prove this is the case, but I sort of have a gut feeling that among toys, you are more likely to find – inventions that are classed as somewhat accidental type inventions. We might talk about more of those in the future. But the Slinky is usually thought of as something like this because it wasn't something that was, you know, created originally to be a toy. It's right. Like he saw something. He's like, that looks kind of fun. It could be a toy. Let me tinker with it, make it even more toy-like. And I guess that's because when you're talking about toys, you don't necessarily start with function. Instead, you just witness something that delights you and you seize on that delight and say, how can I maximize it?
Right. How can we make refined sugar out of this thing that is bringing me pleasure?
Which is funny because unlike a lot of inventions that solve a specific physical problem, delight is subjective, and yet there are, for whatever reason, these certain forms that tend to delight more than slightly altered versions of the same form might.
Yeah. Now, I will say with jigsaw puzzles, when you're doing one, you do feel like you're really engaging your brain.
Yeah.
So it It perhaps doesn't necessarily feel like pure novelty, but yet it also is. It's an artificial problem that you have that you are amusing yourself with.
Sure,
it's not something that would occur in. I mean, I suppose if you were putting back together, say, a broken piece of pottery, but otherwise, no one comes up and says, "Oh, why is this my favorite painting has been cut into a variety of interlocking shapes, and now I must put it back together so I can observe it again."
That's like some kind of like Banksy performance art prank kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be a good one. Yeah, like a self jigsaw puzzling painting. Yeah.
Okay, well, does that do it for today?
I believe so. That's all we have in the toy bag for today. But we're not entirely certain, but we might just keep going with toys for the month of December. There are obviously more toys in the history of invention, and there's some more interesting origin stories to consider.
All right.
In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Invention, head on over to InventionPod.com. You'll also find the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to support Invention, you want to see Invention continue in the new year, the best thing you can do is make sure you have subscribed and then rate and review the show. And hey, tell a friend. Spread the word. If you like Invention, share it with the world.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.